Okay, so welcome to the walkthrough for problem set 3. This is game of 15. Do you guys know game of 15? The little party favor, the plastic little, do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, so not the most fun game, but a pretty good exercise in programming nonetheless. So it'll be a really fun problem set to do. I personally, this is one of my favorite problem sets, and I'm really excited to get into the game, but first there's other functions that we have to talk about. We have to make sure you guys are comfortable with search and sort and find. So we're going to dive right in. And this is our agenda for today. It's a little bit more than we've been doing in other walkthroughs. Here's actually better to see. So first we're going to go to the file generate.c. Generate.c is part of the distribution code that you're given for this week's problem set. So this is already written. Generate.c, we're going to take a look at it. It's already written for you. All that you have to do is put comments throughout the program so that we can test that you guys know, first of all, how to comment, and two, that you guys can figure out from looking at the code what it's doing. So it's generate.c. We're going to take a look at a make file as well. So up until now, you guys have been using the command make for make Caesar, make Visionaire to compile your programs. We're going to take a look at what that make file is actually composed of and how it actually works. We'll look at a make file, and then we're going to go to find.c, which is also written for you, albeit with some parts missing. So the problem set spec will tell you, oops, we forgot to write search, and oh, we also forgot to write sort. So those are the two key components that you guys are going to have to build for find to work. And find is basically the needle in the haystack problem. So it's searching through an array of numbers for the specific number that you're looking for. And then we'll go to 15. And 15 is the heart of this problem set. It's really fun, like I said. And there is distribution code there, too, that we'll go through. The main function is basically written for you. But the main function calls other functions, four of which have not been written, and those are your main task, to write those four functions. So those four functions are initialize, or init, draw, move, and one. And we'll dive into each of these functions and work on implementing those. We're also going to take, I know you guys did it in lecture, you looked at GDB, but we'll take another look at GDB because it really is a very valuable resource that you guys should get in the habit of using. So a lot of the time, maybe you guys went to office hours and asked a TF a question and they said, well, have you tried GDB? And after this week, you basically will have been expected to have tried GDB before coming to us with your questions, right? Because you have to find these ways to help yourself, and GDB is a great resource to do that. So let's dive right in. So first we're going to look at generate.c. So what does generate.c do? Right here I'm on the course website. I'm looking under problem sets. I'm just looking at the source code. So this, you can look at it here. You can look at it in terminal. I think this might be, well, let me see. If we can see this well, then maybe we'll just do it in here. So I'm in my pset3 directory. I'm going to list what's in that directory, and I have two folders, 15 and find. I'm going to go into the find folder, because we're going to handle that first, and I'm going to see what's inside there. And here I have this program generate.c that I'm talking about. So I'm going to open it in Nano. And can we see this, Chris? It's good? Okay. So here is generate.c. So what does it do? You can read it right in the comments. What does generate.c do?
Generates a random number from 0 to 11.
Yeah, so it'll generate a certain number of random numbers. How many random numbers is it going to generate? N. And N is what you give it at the command line, right? So last time you guys worked with command line arguments, and here you're going to run a program that uses command line arguments. Great. So what's this S here? You see usage generate, which is the name of the program. And if you want to sit on this side, I'm going to use this board a bit today, so it would be better if you can sit on the side. So N is the number of random numbers that you want this program to generate. And what is S? The seed. Why do we need a seed? What does it mean to have a seed? Yeah, so it's to tell Rand where to start from, right? Because we already discussed this isn't it doesn't really generate random numbers. It generates pseudo-random numbers. So they're based off a certain seed. Now, why is this S argument in brackets? What does that mean? You don't need it, right? It's an optional argument. So you can do generate n without putting an s. And if you do that, then what will the random number generator use as its seed? Oops. Yeah, the time of the day. Exactly. So that's the usage. And now you're going to go through, and you can see this program. What you have to do is fill in all of these to-do comment me with actual comments. So you're just going to go through every step of this program and decide, well, what does this line do? Or, like, what does this block of code do? And you're just going to fill those out. Okay? It's pretty straightforward. It's not very long. This should just be, like, a warm-up exercise for you. So that's generate. So that's basically generate.c. You just comment the blocks of code that are there. So let's take a look at the make file. So we're looking at the make file. Basically, this is what the computer refers to when you say make Caesar, or in this case, you're going to make generate or make find. And let's look first at this line where it's find. So when you run make find, it's going to refer to all these files after the colon. So find.c, helpers.c, and helpers.h. Helpers.h is just the header file, so that includes all the functions in helpers.c, but it doesn't include all of the code. That code is in helpers.c, and that's where you're going to be writing most of yours. And then find.c is the main function that makes these function calls to functions written in helpers.c and referenced in helpers.h. So in order to compile this, you have to compile all of these files. So this make file says when I say make find, you actually have to go through to all of these files in order to compile them. This also means that if you make a change in any of these three, you have to remake find. So you don't make helpers, you make find, and then that will compile all three together. Okay? And then you see all of these switches here. Right? So you want to go through and make sure that you understand each of these switches. So GCC, that's the compiler. Dash G GDB enables GDB debugging for this, which is what we'll do, which we'll do later with 15. This is what version of C we're using, et cetera, et cetera. This treats warnings as errors. So sometimes you guys get a warning and you say, well, why can't I compile my code? And it's because we're telling, by including this in the make file, we're telling the compiler to not compile your code if you have any warnings. Now, warnings aren't as bad as errors. They're usually like, you define this variable, you initialized it, but then you never used it. So that'll tell you a warning because it'll say, are you sure you didn't actually want to use this? And so since all of these things are probably mistakes and probably errors, we're going to tell it to treat it as errors. And then here you can see the familiar portion, dash O, find.c, helpers.c. So that means compile both of these and name the compiled version, so the actual executable, and name that find. And then over at the end, you have all the libraries that you included, right? So that's for find. The same thing happens for generate. What does clean do? What does clean do? If you do make find, that compiles find. If you do make generate, it creates generate. What happens if you do make clean? It removes all of these files. It'll remove anything that ends in .o, anything called a.out, anything called core. Core would be core dumps, right? So if you had a segmentation fault and it said core dumped, now you have a file in your directory that you can actually see that's called core. And that contains everything that was in the program's memory at the time that it crashed. But this isn't something you want to submit with your problem set, right? You don't want to submit any core dumps. You don't want to submit any a.outs. And then if you want to clear out everything that you've already made, you can run clean to get rid of everything, and then you can make again. So if you've made some sort of mistakes, you have a bunch of junk files in your folder, you can make clean. So that's what make clean does. And then make all will make both find and generate. So it's just simplified for you. So if you want to make both at the same time, just do make all. So that's basically the make file. We just want to introduce you to it so that you know what's actually going on when you call make. So that's the make file. And then we're going to launch into find.c. So you look inside find.c and you see that helpers.h is included, so that header file is included. So you know that some of that code is also being referenced in this file. So you go into the main function. Basically, it's commented for you. You can see what each piece does. This argc is very similar to what you did in Caesar and in Visionaire. You're using A to I to convert the string that's given to you at the command line for the number of for the number that you're passing in that you're trying to find, which we call the needle. So you convert that to an integer and store it in needle. And then you're going to fill the haystack with values, and you've already passed in what value you're looking for. And if it finds that value n inside the haystack, it'll return true. And if it doesn't, it'll return false. So in order to do this search, this is basically a search for a number within an array. And in order to do this search, this main function is calling a function called sort. It's passing it the haystack, which is the array. And it's passing the size of that array to this function sort. And it expects that sort will return that sort will actually sort the haystack, right? So you're passing the actual array, and you expect that after this function call, that array will be sorted. But you guys are the ones who actually have to write this sort function. And then here it just runs search on that haystack, which should now be sorted. Okay, so here's the function call to sort, which you're writing, and here's the function call to search, which you're also writing. And that's the bulk of find.c. So that's the main function, and it's calling sort and search. So now if we look into helpers.c, that's actually where those two functions are written, and that's where you will have to actually write those functions. So search is written for you, but what kind of search is this? So take a minute, look at it. What kind of search is this? Linear, exactly. So this is linear search. So this takes an array, right, which is the haystack, and it's going to look through every element in the haystack and say, is this the value I'm looking for? No. Is this the value I'm looking for? No. It's going to go all the way through searching every element. Okay, so what is the runtime of linear search? It's n, right? So if there are 10 elements in the array, it takes 10 steps to do this search, right? Because you're looking at each element saying, is this what I'm looking for? No. Is this what I'm looking for? No. And in the worst case scenario, you're doing it 10 times, okay? So what you have to do is re-implement this as binary search, which is faster, right? What's the runtime of binary search? Log n, exactly. It's log n, so it's much faster because every time that you go through, right? So you're not just going through mindlessly from the first to the second to the third. Every time that you go through, you're cutting the problem in half. So this is like David ripping the phone book in half, or having a volunteer rip the phone book in half. Every time you go through, you're reducing the size of the problem by half, and that makes it a logarithmic runtime. So what you guys have to do is implement this as binary search. So let's go back to the PowerPoint. Oh, okay. Dash W all enables all warnings. So dash W error makes all warnings errors, and W dash W all makes it print out all the warnings. There you go. And anytime you have questions like that, you can really just Google them and see, which is what we would do as well if I had Google in front of me. Okay. So. So we have linear search, right? We can make it better. We can make it binary because it's much faster. It's halving the problem every time you go through. So there are two main ways of implementing binary search. So the first is an iterative way, and the second is recursive. So let's look at the iterative, and you can choose whichever one makes the most intuitive sense to you. For some people, it's really much easier to think of things iteratively. For others, it's much easier to think of them recursively. And we'll go through both so you can get a feel for which one might make more sense to you. So basically, if you're doing binary search on an array, just don't even look at the slide yet because I don't want you to get confused. Just thinking of the phone book example, for example. If you're doing a binary search, what's the first thing you do? You're looking for a name in the phone book. What's the first thing you do? Open it to the middle, right? So that's the same thing here, right? And this is pseudocode for you. So the first thing is you go to the middle. And then you see you're looking for the value k, right? K is the needle that we're trying to find in this haystack in this array. So you go to the middle, and you see if k is less than the value at the middle of the array. And what if it is? Then you don't care about anything to the right of the middle, right? You don't care about anything after the middle. So you might as you now you only care from the first until the one right before the middle, right? So you can basically treat that as a new array, right? Just like you can treat half the phone book that you haven't thrown away as a new phone book, you can treat half of this array as a new array. So now what's the first element in your array if we've moved to the left? So if k is less than the value at the middle, we throw out the middle and everything to the right of it. Now we have a new array. What's the first element in our new array? It was the first element in the old array as well, right? So the first element doesn't change. What about the last element? What's the last element now with regard to the original array? It's whatever's in the middle, not whatever's before k. K is what we're looking for. So k is the value that we're looking for. And let's say we're at the middle, and let's say we have a variable called middle to know what index is the middle. So let's say I have an array of 9 values. What's the value of middle? 5. So the middle value is at index 5. So now let's say middle is 5. First is what? 0. And let's say k is less than the value at index 5. So now what becomes last?
4.
Last is 4, exactly. Or last is middle minus 1. Yes?
If 9 arrays, middle index would be a 4, right? Because index starts
with 4. Oh, sorry, you're right.
3.
You're right. So now you'd be at 3. So the he pointed out, yeah, so if you have 10 items, then you're actually from 0 to 9, so the middle is... Right. You have 9 items, 0, 0. Right. Okay, but you get the point. So the middle, you have a variable that stores the middle, and now the last actually becomes middle minus 1. Do you understand why? Because you're treating that as a new array. And now you're in this loop, right? So you're going to do that again, right? Because you want to go to the middle again. You have to recalculate the middle every time. And how do you find what number the middle is, like what index the middle is? 4 more middle minus 1 is now last, so no. What? So let's say first is 0 and last is 3. Or sorry, let's say last is 4. First is 0, last is 4. What's middle? The average, exactly. So you take the average of the first and the last to find the new middle. Okay? So you start with, if you have an array of n values, you start with first being 0, last being what? N minus 1, right? If you have n values, n minus 1. And then the middle would be the sum of 0 and n minus 1 divided by 2. And you can round, you can pick a way to round, but be consistent. Okay, so you find that middle. Then the next time, if you're going to the left, the first is still 0, the last is going to be the middle minus 1, and then the average of those will be the new middle. And you keep going in this loop until your first passes your last, right? So if first is staying at 0, for example, and then this comes to 0, then you know, well, I haven't found my value, so I can exit this loop. Or if first is moving this way and passes last, then you also know you haven't found the value, so you return false. But if we go back to the pseudocode, if at any point k equals the value at the middle, then you return true.
Oh, there's no guarantee that what you're looking
for is in here. There's no guarantee that what you're looking for is in here. No. That's why you're doing the search function, right? Because you're trying to find out if it's there.
Also, who said these are in order?
Well, exactly. That's why we're going to implement sort next. So what I was going to say is, okay, great, so now we know how to implement binary search, but what's the use of binary search if we don't have a sorted array? So we've made an improvement, but now we have to write another function in order to make this actually possible. So we're going to do that next, but we still have another way of looking at binary search. So this was the iterative way. This is the recursive way. So what does it mean if a function is recursive?
It calls its
It means that it calls itself, exactly. So this is a version of binary search that actually calls itself. And to me, this makes a lot of sense because you're effectively running a search over and over again just on smaller and smaller arrays. So if you start with your big array, and this search function takes the array, the first, the index of the first, the index of the last, and the value you're looking for, k, then you can keep calling this function, just changing these arguments, right? An array is never going to change because you're always working with the same actual array, the same place in memory. And k is never going to change because you're always looking for that value. So the things that you're going to change every time you call this function are first and last. And you change it in very much the same way that we did on the previous slide. So if first is greater than last, return false. So same thing that we did before. If we've already passed them, that means we've gone through and we haven't found it. So return false. Otherwise, if k is less than the value at the middle, then run this search on the same array, the same first index, but now last is middle minus 1, and we're still looking for k. So that's if k is less. And then I have dot, 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 because if k is greater, we're going to change first, and then last will still be last. And then if k is equal, then we found our value, right? So we can return true. So this function will keep calling itself. And there's no real preference for which version you do, the previous slide or this one. It's whatever makes the most sense to you. Okay, because they'll do the same thing. So now we've implemented binary search. So like someone pointed out, we need to have a sorted list in order for binary search to work, right? So now we're going to do sort. So your task is to implement a sort function that runs in O of n squared, okay? Which is most of the sort functions that you guys covered in lecture. So one of those is bubble search. So bubble search, this is your basic pseudocode. Let me actually show you. This isn't the most compelling video. It's not funny or interesting at all, but it gets the point across really well. So let's watch this animation of bubble sort. Okay. So it compares the first two. If the one to the right is smaller than the one to the left, it just swaps them, right? So this is your basic bubble search. It's going to swap them. It's going to swap them. It's going to swap them. It's not going to swap those at the end. Okay, get the basic idea of bubble sort? Yeah, so it compares them two at a time, and if they're in the wrong order, it'll just swap them. So the way this looks in pseudocode is very similar to what I just said. For n times, where n is the size of your array, for each element in the array, if it and the element next to it are in the wrong order, swap them. So you compare them. So for example, if element I is greater than element I plus 1, then you want to swap them, right? Because you want them to be in order from least to greatest. So you basically go through each one, make this comparison, and swap them. So I already told you this, but what is the running time of bubble sort? N squared, yeah. So there's actually, so it's going to be N squared. If we write it just like this, it's going to be N squared in the best case and in the worst case, right? So if the list is already sorted, it's still going to take n squared times because it's just going to keep comparing. Even if it's not swapping anything, it doesn't know that the list is already sorted. It's going to keep comparing. So even in the best case scenario where you give this sort function an already sorted list, it's going to take n squared number of iterations through this loop, right? So there is a way to improve on this. And what's that? Yes.
Swap at all, then just stop.
Exactly. So if you haven't swapped a value at all, then just stop. And that's exactly what I have up here. So what would be the running time of that?
N
in the best case. So in the worst case, it's still going to be n squared. If it's completely unsorted and you need n squared steps. But in the best case, it'll be n. So at least in this case, if you pass it a sorted array, it'll come back to you in linear time, right? It's just going to go through once, realize that it's sorted, and be finished. And the reason To do this, you would just have to keep track somehow of if there's been a swap. So you can have a Boolean that keeps track of if you've swapped anything in that run through the loop. And if the Boolean is false, like there no swaps have been made, then you know that your list is sorted. And that way you'll stop early. Or you'll stop as soon as your list is sorted instead of going through redundantly. Makes sense. That's an improvement on bubble sort. Another sort you can do, and this isn't exhaustive. Like there are other sorts as well, but the two I'm focusing on are bubble sort and selection sort. And you can do other ones as well. So what does selection sort do? I have an animation of this too. I'm sorry that my animations are really not interesting at all. But okay, wait. This one's okay. Start over. Okay. So watch it. So it finds the smallest value. So it found the 0 and it puts it in the first spot in the array. It found the 1. It put it in the second spot in the array. And it keeps going through, finding the smallest one. And what does it do once it finds the smallest one?
It swaps it
with wherever it's up to now, right? So the pink is going, sorry, the yellow is going down, right? So once you've already done the 0, the 1, and the 2, you never have to go back to that part of the list again, right? And then you're on 4, or like you're on array bracket 4, and you just have to find the next smallest and swap it with whatever is at array bracket 4 right now. Why would you need to protect against multiple identical values in the same array? Well, you would. So the question is, what if you have two of the same value in the array? Well, if they're identical, you wouldn't just do if it's less than or if it's greater than. You would have one of them be less than or equal to.
Yes,
yeah,
so you just protect.
Yeah, there's nothing like automatically built in. You have to account for it, and your sort function has to work even if you have two of the same element in the array. So if there are two 4s, it should still be able to sort them and just put the two 4s next to each other.
Okay. And another question over here.
Yeah.
Do arrays in general have locations or indexes in them that don't have any value? Is there a default value? I could probably expose it before, but what is it? You have to find, you know, an array with a size 4 and just only define like one or two of the
okay, so the question is, what happens if you don't initialize all the spaces in your array? So they'll probably have junk values in them, or they might have zeros. Like, you'd be lucky if they had zeros, because that would work for you, because you would know, oh, I just didn't initialize it, but you could also have junk values in there. So you should always initialize your arrays. And in this, in find, actually, you're filling the haystack. You're filling this array with values. So the user is prompted, what do you want to be in haystack bracket 0? And they put in a value. So you don't really have to worry about it being null, because the user is filling it in. So back to the sorting. So selection sort would work. You would start with an I. You'd make I equal to 0. And then for the number of times as there are elements inside your array, so n times, you would find the smallest value, which we'll call s. You can call it whatever you want. Between index I and the end, which is n minus 1. And you would swap s with the value at location I. And then you would increment I. So you're at 0, you find the smallest value, you swap its location with whatever's at 0, at index 0 right now, then you move on to index 1. You find the next smallest, so you don't look at the early one anymore, otherwise that'll always be the smallest. So don't look to the left anymore, look only whatever's left, find the next smallest, swap it with whatever's at index 1, and move along. Does that make sense? And the running time of this?
Squared.
N squared, exactly. Same thing. So no preference. You can do either one. Just make sure that you do a sort, because otherwise we can't use binary search. We have to use binary search. So you can pick any sorting method. You can use insertion sort. You can use any sorting method. These are just two that I wanted to walk through here. Sound good? Okay. Let's move on to 15. So 15, it's going to be really fun. You have a bunch of distribution code already. So I'm going to go back to my pset3 directory. I'm going to go into the 15 folder. Oops. Okay. So I have 15.c here. Also, you have another make file. So this is going to look similar to the other one. You should look into it for curiosity's sake. But let's go into 15.c because there's already some code written for you here. So we're going to go... Oh, sorry. It's being very slow. Bear with me. I promise I'm typing something. I don't know. Sometimes it's my computer, but sometimes it's... Oh, here we go. Nano15.c. Okay, there we go. Okay, so we're in 15.c. You already have code written for you. This is the basic framework of the game, so this is what you're working from. You should go through this more slowly than I'm going to do right now, just to make sure you understand every piece. But basically, you have minimum dimensions and maximum dimensions, so your board has to be between 3x3 and 9x9, and it has to be a square. So you can't have a 10x10 board, you can't have a 2x2 board. That's just how we're going to work this game. Sorry, this isn't even letting me scroll. Okay, so now it scrolled too far. Okay, so let's look at these global variables that we have. So we have these constants that are the minimum and maximum dimension. Those are never going to change. Those are constant. Then we have the board. And what type is this board? What kind of construction is being used to symbolize the board, or to implement the board, really, of this game? It's an array of ints, and what kind of array is it? It's a two-dimensional array, right? So I have this drawn up here. This is basically what you can envision your array as looking like. So I always like to think of this as the actual physical game board, because it helps me a lot to understand what's actually going on. You are implementing this game board as a two-dimensional array of integers. So basically that looks like a box. So if the height and the width are 4, then this is what that's going to look like, right? It's going to be a two-dimensional array, and everything in these boxes is going to be ints. Every value is going to be an integer. Okay, so you're filling these boxes with integers, and that's basically what it looks like under the hood. Okay, so here we have that board set up. So basically what I have drawn here is what this line of code does. So it creates a two-dimensional array of ints in order to store all the values on this board. Int D is going to be where you store the dimensions of the board. So that's going to be, in this case, what's a D? In the case that I have drawn on the board. 4. So D is 4. And we don't need a height and a width because it's a square. So D is the height and D is also the width. Okay, and then here you have prototypes of all the functions that this main function is going to call. The prototypes are listed above main because main needs to know at the time that it's being compiled that these functions exist, what types they return, and what arguments they take. So 4 of these functions are void, which means they don't really return anything. So they apply some sort of change or they do something, but they don't really have a return value. They also don't take any arguments, so they take void. Basically, when you call them, you don't actually have to put void, but when you declare them, you have to say that they take void. And then 2 of them are Boolean expressions, which means what? What do they return?
True or false.
True or false, exactly. And this move takes an argument. It takes a tile, is what we're calling that argument, and it's of type int. So when you call move, you would say move parentheses 5, for example. And that would mean move the tile that has the value 5. We'll deal with this when we actually get to move. But here we're declaring it like that. And then 1 takes a void. It doesn't take anything. And it's also Boolean. So it's saying, is the game won or not? So 1 makes sense why it would be a Boolean. But why is move a Boolean? Yeah, you need to know if the move is possible and if it was successful. So sometimes a move won't be possible. So the user will say, I want to switch these two tiles. But if those two tiles can't be switched because one of them is not a blank, then you return false. And the main function is going to deal with that. So CS50 has already written for you the framework, and you only have to write 4 of the functions. So let's just quickly see what this does. So it greets the user. That's the function greet, already been written. Then it checks if the person is using it correctly. So if they didn't, it specifies what the usage is. And the usage is what? We can go up here, I believe. It's actually written out. It won't let me scroll. Okay, what's the usage? You have to specify the dimensions of the board, right? So you only put 1 value because it's a square, right? So if you say 15.3, it's going to be a 3x3 board. Okay, great. So you ensure that the dimensions are valid, which means we have to make sure that the dimensions are between the minimum and the maximum, which are our constants, 3 and 9. So you make sure that the board is somewhere between that.
And if it isn't, then you complain to the user, you return to an exit. Then we have initialize the board, which is what you guys are going to have to do. So that means we have this array of integers, we have this two-dimensional array, but there are no values inside of it right now, right? We have to populate that array with the values that represent the board and that allow for gameplay. So initializing the board is not drawing the board. Drawing the board is another function which we'll get to. Initializing is just under the hood, we have to store values in this array that represent the values on the board. So that's what initialize is going to do. And then you're going to allow the game to be played. And this is already done for you as well. So while true, clear the screen. You clear the screen because every time something happens, we actually have to redraw the screen. You're not just going to swap values by saying, well, move this over and put that there. We're just going to redraw it. So whenever a move happens, we change what's actually stored under the hood in our array of integers that represents the board. And then we just redraw the board. Okay, so draw is not only the first time you draw it, so you can't hard code values in because it's going to change as the game is being played. So draw redraws the board with every move. Well, that's what we're gonna do. Well, every time a move happens, this is what we're gonna do in the function move. But every time a move happens, we're going to alter the array that stores the values that are on the board right now. And draw is going to draw the board based on the values in that array. We're going to go into all these functions. I'm just showing you where they're actually called in main. But we are going to go through each one. Then we have a condition here where we're checking if the game is already won. And if the game is won, we're going to break the game. It's not going to keep. We're not going to allow for any more moves if the game has already been won. So we have to write that Boolean function that returns true if the game has been won and returns false if it hasn't. Then this game asks the person, well, okay, so assuming the game has not been won, so I've cleared the screen, I've drawn the board as it is right now, I've made sure that the game hasn't been won yet, and now I'm ready to ask the person what move they'd like to make, because I know that there's still play. So just printf, what tile do you want to move, use a getInt to get that tile. So all this is written for you not because it's particularly hard. You guys know how to write all of this that we've seen so far, but just so you guys can focus on what's actually interesting in this problem and not the same thing that you've been doing in the last two problem sets, like getInt, for example. Okay, so if not move tile, so remember, move takes a tile, and it'll return true or false. It'll return true if it was able to move that tile. It'll return false if it hasn't been able to. Okay, so if it's able to move it, if it's not able to move it, it'll printf illegal move. If it is able to move it, we don't actually have to do anything because move has already done it. We've called the function move. Even though it looks like a condition here, we're actually making the function call right there in the condition. Okay? And the return value, I mean, if it's false, we have to account for that, but if it's true, we can move on. We don't really have to do anything because move has already made this move. Right? Okay, and this is just animation, this you sleep, and then we return zero, and that's it. So here's the heart of what you guys are doing. So we already have clear, that's already been written, that's just using escape sequences to just clear the whole board and give you a new, kind of, it looks like a new window, sort of. Then we're going to greet the player, we're just going to printf, welcome to the game, that's all that's already been done. And then here's the first thing we have to do. So we have to initialize the board. So here's where you guys can totally just focus on the board now. There's nothing more on these slides in this distribution code because all of them now are to do because this is all what you guys are gonna have to do. So we already have this, right? This has already been done in the main function. We have the board. It's been created. It's a two-dimensional array of integers. Now we have to initialize that board. So at the beginning, when the game is starting to be played, how does the board look? It should be backwards, right? So what's going to be up here?
15.
Yeah, let's say, so in a 4x4 board, so this isn't the general case. This isn't, no, you're right. Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. So there are 16 spots, right? But in terms of how the board looks at the beginning of gameplay, this is a 15, right? This is 14, 13, 12, et cetera. And then what does the last row look like? Careful. 3, 1, 2, exactly. So it's actually, so what's D in this case? 4, this is 4. When D is even,
When D is an even number, the last two tiles need to be swapped. And this is just for the sake of the game working out. This isn't like a trick that we want you guys to be able to do. This is just, this is how the board game actually works. So without this, you won't be able to solve the puzzle. So keep that in mind. When D is even, these two are swapped. When D is odd, these are normal. Okay, so this would just be 3, 2, 1. Okay, so basically this is 15, 14, 13, exactly. But this is only in the case where D is 4. We need to initialize our board so that it works with whatever D is. So what's the top left box going to have? What value, if this is not 4, but this is just D? What's this 15 going to be? D squared minus 1, exactly. So you're going to start with the value D squared minus 1, and what are you going to end with? Or like what are, not taking into account this swap yet. You're going from D, your values inside this board are going to range from D squared minus 1 to what? To 1, right? So you need to initialize this board so that you have each of these values. Yes? You don't distribute these randomly. This is the way that the board is set up, is that when the game... Yeah, you have to start the game with them in order. You start the game with this from the highest value down to the lowest value, and if it's an even number, you swap these. That's like the standard way of starting this game. So, for example, if you actually bought this game, that's how the board would be set up when you bought it. Okay. So we're going from D squared minus 1 to 1, and how are we referring to each of these boxes? So when we have a two-dimensional array, how do we sort of refer? So we have, let's say this is called board, which it actually is. So let's say we have board. And how? What's this in board? What's this top left box? Not what value is inside of it, but where is it located? Zero what? Zero, zero, right? So this is board 0, 0. This is board what? 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 3. What's this? Board 1, 0. Exactly. So what kind of construct, what could we do to go through each of these? Because it's in, this is row 0, this is row 1, this is row 2, this is row 3. This is column 0, column 1, column 2, column 3, right? If we have a 4 by 4. So how do we iterate, how do we go through these and these? What can we create to do this? A for loop, okay. So one for loop? Nested for loops, right? So that one for loop is keeping track of the rows and the other for loop is keeping track of the columns. So let's say that these values okay, let's say that these values are in I and these are in J. Okay, so you have one for loop that goes that iterates over I and the other one that iterates over J. So each one of these boxes is going to be what? A board IJ, exactly. So this would be board IJ. And when I and J are both zero, what value, what int do you want to store in that board? Or more generally, D squared minus 1. Exactly. So you start with D squared minus 1 and you put it in board 0, 0. As the for loop iterates, so you're inside I is 0 right now. Then you're entering your J for loop. J starts off at 0. You store in board 0, 0 the value D squared minus 1, right? And then J enters again, and now J is 1. So now we're at board 0, 1, which is where? Here. Yeah. So now we're here, and what do we want to store in here? D squared minus 2, right. So instead of maybe doing D squared minus 1, D squared minus 2, you might want to just start, you might want to store D squared minus 1 in some variable and then just decrement that variable as you go through your for loop.
right? So every time you stored a number, then decrease the value of this variable. And then you store all those in. So now this isn't actually drawing the board, remember. This is just storing the values under the hood. So one thing you have to, there are two things that you have to account for here. One is that if D is even, after you've done all of this, you have to swap these two values, or the second to last and the third to last value. So one challenge is thinking, well, what is this piece of the board called? Don't say it. Think, this is a problem that you guys have to solve. So what is this part of the board called? What is this part of the board called? Not only when D is equal to 4, but for any D. You have to identify what these are called, and then you'll probably want to write a swap function, right? And you've seen those in lecture probably. You'll want to write a swap function to swap those two values. And incidentally, you'll need your swap function a bunch of times when you're actually playing the game. Because every time you move tiles, you're actually swapping them. And we'll get to that when you move. Basically, you're initializing your board with these values. One thing you have to account for is swapping these two if D is even. The other thing you have to account for is you also have to initialize this last tile, this blank tile. So like we said before, this is now 3, 1, 2, but then this one is a blank. This is the space that you can move. All the rest of these have values, but you always have one blank one, right? Like if you buy the actual game, there's one tile missing. It's taken out. But you guys actually have to have a value for this tile because you don't want to just leave junk values in there. You want to initialize every tile. But you want to have a special value for this tile so that you know that that's the blank tile. So yeah, you can use the ASCII value for space. Yeah, that's one way of doing it. You want to think about what way makes the most sense. You're going to need this space when you're moving to check if it's a blank space. You're also going to need the space to check if the game has been won. Okay, and we'll get to this when we get to win, but you're always going to have to check where this space is, because when the game has been won, that space also has to be in the right place. Right? So one way of storing this space is just as a zero, right? Because we're never using the value zero. Another way is as d squared, because we're also not using d squared. Another way is, that was mentioned, you could use the ASCII value for a space. There are many ways to do this. Just make sure that you also initialize the space. Don't just initialize from d squared minus 1 until 1. You also have to put a value in that space. That makes sense? Yes?
Could you print the board and then could you print 0 as for the space, or would you want to have such a nice statement every time, and if it's 0, then print a space?
So the question was, when you actually print the board, do you want to print 0 for the space? So just to be perfectly clear, we're not printing the board here. I know that you understand, but just so that everyone's clear, we're not printing the board here. We're just initializing the values. So you can initialize it as a 0. I believe that you actually want to print it as a space or as an underscore or as something. I don't think you want to print a 0 there. You want to print either a space or... So that's why you have to know what this value is, because when you draw the board, you want this value to look different. You don't want it to be a 0. You want it to be either an underscore or a space or several spaces, whatever. Okay? Okay. So drawing the board. So what tool have we always used to draw?
Printf,
right? So we're going to use a printf that's going to print these variables, right? And now, stylistically, you can do this however you want, really. You can make your board really wide, or you can make it really small. It doesn't really matter, but play around with the printf to make it very clear that these are tiles. Make sure that all of them are, I mean, they're all going to be the same size, but make sure, like, if you have a 15 and a 3, they take up a different amount of space normally, right? So you want to account for that with like the width of your printf. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, you'll want to look at the man page for printf, or you'll want to Google printf and see how you can specify exactly how wide you're going to print a variable. And you'll want to use that. So it's completely up to you how wide you want them to be, but you basically want each tile to be the same width. You don't want the number 15 to take up like two spaces and then have the number 3 take up one space, because your board will look crooked. Right, so this is a consideration in drawing the board. And then for each spot in the board, you have to know what value to put in it. So we have the array board, board like this, basically, with our I and J, right? We've already said this. So you basically want to go through and print out each of these inside that you can use the nested for loop construct that you did in initialize, very similar. And just every time you go to a new row, you also just have to put a backslash n in there. Right? So one for loop is going to be going through columns. That's fine. But every time you go to a new row, you want to do a backslash n so that you're on a new line. And that's very simple, just how you'll print the board. So you're going to use, it's, I'd be surprised if it was more than 4 or 5 lines. That's not, don't quote me on that. I mean, it's not deaf and don't say, oh, mine's not 4 or 5 lines. I did it wrong. I'm just saying this is very short. This is very simple. You basically want to account for this space that'll take up some lines in your printf, in your draw function, I mean. And you want to make sure that they're all the same width, and you want to make sure the right values are being stored in them. Another thing is, after you write each one of these, you want to make sure that it's working, right? So you want to make sure that after you've written the draw function, just call draw and see that your board looks right before you move on to move, because that makes sense, right? You want to make sure each small piece is done right before you move on, because it's much easier to debug if you know that the problem has to be in the function that you just wrote. Make sense? Yes. Oh, no, I don't mean call the specific function at the command line. I just mean once you've written draw, then run the program, and all it'll do is draw, because you haven't written move yet, so it won't allow you to move anything, but you'll be able to see what's happened. Yeah. Okay, so after we've drawn the board using all the values in our two-dimensional array of integers, we're going to allow the player to move. So remember, this is a Boolean. Don't forget that, because it's not that intuitive. You don't think of move as a Boolean, because it's not really a question. But we actually want to return true if we've successfully moved the tiles, and return false if we haven't. So the basic logic is you check for a blank space. So this is why it's really important to initialize your blank space, so that you know what the value inside of a blank space is. So if it was 0, for example, you would check, is the value that I'm trying to swap with 0? If it is, you swap. Now let's actually think about how this would work. So let's say I have this board. We're going to pretend that all these are full, and this is the blank space. So for the sake of time, I'm not going to fill them all out, but let's pretend all of these are full. Let's do this, I guess. Okay. And then this is the blank space. So if I say, I want to move the number 2, what do you have to do? So the user is going to give you an int called tile. Tile is getting passed to the function move. So you have this int tile, and that represents what the person wants to move. So right now I said, I want to move the 2. That means tile equals 2. Okay, right now. That's what's being passed to your move function. So what do you want to do right now? Yes. You want to check for all of the spaces around tile, exactly. But you don't really know where tile is yet, right? So first you have to find tile, so find the 2. And then you have to check around the 2. So they're not going to say, move the 2 to the right. They're just going to say 2, so that means move the 2. So you have to check all around the 2. You have to check, is this a blank space? Is this a blank space? Is this a blank space? But what happens if I check this? Exactly. You're accessing memory that you don't have. So you might get a seg fault if you do that. So you want to make sure, this is a condition you're going to have to put in. If you're in the last row, do not check any lower. If you're in the first row, do not check any farther to the left. If you're in the top row, don't go any farther up, etc. If you're in the right row, don't go any farther right. So you have to implement a check for this. So assuming you're checking for this, you just want to make sure that one of the tiles next to it is a blank. So if you're representing the blank as D squared, for example, you check if this is board IJ at this time, right? This is board IJ, where we are now in our for loop. So I want to go check if this one is blank. So what do I check for? What's the memory, what's the location of this? Right, but what's the board what? Exactly. So if this is board IJ, this is board IJ plus 1. Right? What's this? I minus 1J. What's this one? ij minus 1. Yeah. And this one you don't want to go to, but if we were somewhere in the middle, the one below would be I plus 1j. Right. Yeah, so the ij is inside your nested for loop, right? We already said the way we represent this board is with the two-dimensional array, and the way we traverse a two-dimensional array is with nested for loops.
So I and j are numbers,
yeah, I and j, well, we're doing the general case. So I and j, if you're here, it's still board ij, right? Just I and j are changing. So the one to the right is always going to be ij plus 1. But you have to check that I is not equal to the max I for that case, right? Yeah.
How do you find number 2? Do you have to check?
Yeah, so you have to actually go through every single one and find the 2. No, there's no shortcut. Yeah. So you have to find the 2, then you have to check all around the 2, making sure that you don't check outside the array. So in this case, if I is 3, I don't want to check below. I don't want to check I plus 1. If j is 3 here, I don't want to check j plus 1 for a space. Okay, and then if I find a space, I swap, right? So I have some swap function that I've written, and if I find that this is a space, in fact, I'm going to call swap on board ij and board ij plus 1. That'll swap, and then what do I have to do still? What do I have to do?
Redraw.
No. Redrawing is happening in main. What do I have to do in move still?
Make that a Z, make that a blank space.
No, so if I've swapped, that's already taken into account what the new blank space is going to be. But how does move have to end?
True.
Exactly. I have to return a true if I've swapped them. And if none of these are blank, then what do? You return false. Exactly. Make sense? Okay. So you only have one more function. So that's the won function. And this is also Boolean. You have to check if the game has been won. So there are many ways you can do this. I have 2 of them listed here. You can check that all of these numbers are sorted from least to greatest. So again, you have this construction of the nested for loop. You go through each one and you make sure that it's greater than the one before it, because you want to end up with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? So you remember what this is, and then you go into the for loop again, you make sure this is greater than this, and you keep going until the end. That's one way of doing it. You wouldn't need to use a sort, because you're not trying to sort this two-dimensional array. You would just iterate through, and you have, okay, the first time it was a 1, so the next time I have to make sure that whatever I have inside that box is greater than this 1. Then the next one has to be greater than 2, the next one has to be greater than 3. Good. Well, what about where the space ends up? So this is where it's interesting what you named your space. So if you wanted to use the all of them are greater than each other thing, then what would you want your space to have a value of? D squared, right, at the end. So you'd want it to be 16 in this case, because then you could just keep saying, well, are they greater? But if you wanted to do the other way I have up there, which is just having some counter variable that keeps incrementing and making sure that the right value is there, you can say something like, like if it's supposed to be d squared, check that there's a 0 there, and then that's fine as well for the last one. You can also, I guess hypothetically, you can disregard the last one, because if you're doing that way, not if you're doing the greater than way, because that could still get you tricked up. But if you are doing the way that's just check each of these values that they're from 1 to 15 in this case, then if all of these are 1 through 15 and you've actually checked each one, then you don't really have to check this. Because if all these are 1 through 15, then you know that the last one is the blank. Any other questions? Okay, so we only have 3 minutes, so let's, before the break, so I'm going to quickly run through GDB, and then we can take all the questions that you guys have, so that people who don't have questions can leave and not stay for the tape break. So let's look at, well, do you want to do a tape break then? Okay, let's do a tape break. We'll be back in 5 minutes. Okay, so you guys did GDB in lecture, right? So we're going to go through it quickly with 15. So I have, I'm going to go into my 15 folder. I'm going to just remake 15 in case I made any changes. Okay, it's up to date. I have to remake it. And now I'm going to run GDB 15. Okay, and now I'm in the GDB mode. So now there are, first of all, I wanted to show you guys, there are, where is it? Oops, sorry. Here on the resources page of the website, there's the GDB quick reference, which is a great guide for, let's see if it, okay. Here's a great guide to basic GDB commands that you're going to need. So basically the one I just called is GDB program. So I ran GDB 15. That's going to enter my program in the debug mode so that I can debug that program. A lot of these you'll never need, but some of the main ones are run. So that's going to run your program. And if your program takes any arguments, this is where you want to put them in. So for 15, I would want to run it with an argument for D for the dimensions, right? So I would do run and then 5. Like that. So GDB, the name of the program, and then run, and then its arguments. So that's a little easy to forget because you're used to running program and then arguments. But now you're entering GDB with your program and then running it with the arguments. So starting GDB, stopping GDB, you just type quit, much easier than stopping other things in Terminal or in PuTTY, incidentally. There's the help that you can access, so you can see what various commands are. Executing, like we said, run. You can kill the program if it's if you're in an infinite loop or something. You'll want to kill it, so you can exit. So that's kill. You already know these for make and cd. Let me see what other ones. So you'll want to do. Okay, let's just do it through with the example. So now I'm in GDB. I'm running the program 15, and I'll do run with the argument 4, so with a height of 4. So if I hit that, it's going to enter the game, and since I haven't actually written any of the functions, right, because you guys have to write the functions, it's going to ask me what tile to move, but none of the tiles have been drawn. I can't actually put in a value. Nothing's going to happen. So basically, this program is pretty broken, right, because you guys haven't written any of the functions, but it still compiles, right? We've written enough for you in these functions that it'll still compile. So basically, I want to kill this now. Control C. Okay. So now I'm back in GDB. So now if I want to only, I don't want to run all the way through because I just saw what happened. It's not very useful to me. Let's say I just want to run until I get to the main function. So I have to create a breakpoint at main. So I would type break main. I actually typed it. It's just slow, so it's not showing up. Okay, so now it says breakpoint 1 at, and that's the memory location, right? And then it says which file, so it's 15.c, and it's line 51. And what's happening at line 51, that means? Main, exactly. So the main function actually starts on line 51. So basically now if I run, sorry. Okay, so it has started already because I was already debugging it. So when it asks you this, you usually want to start from the beginning, right, because you're running it again. So you say yes. It's starting program. It reaches the breakpoint, and it'll give you information about, so now it's at the function main, and it'll tell me what arguments are being passed to main right now. So argc, we know, is the argument count, right? So it's telling me there are 2 arguments, which makes sense because I ran 15 and then the number 4. So those are my 2 arguments. argv is actually an array, right? Argument vector, it's an array. So right now it's just telling me the memory address of the first slot in that array. So don't worry too much about that. But it's interesting that if you break at a certain function, it'll tell you what values are being passed to that function. So if I did like break at move, so break when you get to the function move. Now I've put in a breakpoint there, and I'm going to, let's say I want to step through this. So I want to go line by line. So let's do step. Oh, now I'm at function greet. Great. Let's step again. Now I'm at the printf because it tells you what line it's at right now, and it tells you the next line it's going to execute. So when I was at greet, the next thing I was going to do was clear. And then when I stepped, I think this is it actually entering the clear function, right? So it enters clear, and which is at line 115 because the function call to clear is in main. And then you go down to line, 115, which is where it actually has this printf for clear. And this is just what's inside the function clear, so you know every line that's being executed. So if I keep stepping through, I just have another printf. Let's say I run now, and that'll run until the breakpoint. So I'm at main again. So if you clear, I think it is. Okay, so we've deleted those breakpoints so that I can actually get to my move. So break move, and now run. It's going to run until move. Okay, so now we're at move, and it'll tell you what tile is equal to right there. So you see tile is equal to 3. Well, let's say at this point, for some reason, I wanted to check if I had, let's say I had the for loop ij here, and I wanted to see what I was. I would do print I, and I could see what I is. And then I could step through again and then do print I and make sure that I is incremented the way I wanted it to. Incidentally, I don't have a for loop yet because this function hasn't been written. So I can't print I, but I can print D, for example. And it'll tell me, it just uses this notation for the variable, but it gives me the value 4. So if I say print D and it gives me a 4, that means that D right now is 4, which makes sense, right? Because that's what I've put in. So in this example, it's not giving you much new information because I typed in D. I know what D is. I also typed in this 3 for tile, so I know what tile is. But for some variables, you'll want to know, okay, my program's not working. There must be some sort of bug. Let me see what's actually going on. What number is actually stored in this variable? I think that I've stored the number that I want there, but what if I've actually stored a different number? This is a way of finding out also if you forgot to initialize something. So if you print the value of that variable and it gives you some huge value or some value that seems really random, you're probably going to know, oh, I didn't initialize that, or oh, that's not being accessed the way I want. So this is really valuable, being able to print out each of these variables like this at runtime. So while the program is running, you can see. And so if you step through it slowly, like line by line, you can actually see what's going on as you go through, and you can logically figure out what's going wrong. Does that make sense? Okay, cool. Any questions about anything now? It could be about any of the functions that we've talked about, anything on the problem set, anything we've talked about tonight. Any questions? Yes. Yeah, so next won't actually, I forget which one is which. I think step doesn't go into the actual functions, whereas next does. But it could be the other way around. So one of them will, which one? Step goes into the function. Okay, so if I step through and there's another function call, oh, exactly, the one that I did, remember how it called clear and then it actually went into clear? That's because step will actually go line by line in the function you're calling. But sometimes you know, for example, that the bug is not in that function that's being called. You know the bug is somewhere else, so you don't want to actually go into the function. You don't want to debug there, so you would just want to go next. It'll still execute the function, it won't go to the line in the function, it'll go to whatever happens after that function returns. Yeah. Any other question? You had one?
Yeah. Why do we have to when we initialize the array, when D is even, why do we have to swap
those two numbers? Okay, so when D is even, when we initialize this array, why do we have to swap these two numbers? That's just how the game of 15 works. You won't be able to solve it if they're even and
When
it's odd, you can, yeah. Like if you bought the game board, you would see that the 3, it's 3, 1, 2 in the last line. That's because you can't actually solve it and get them to all be in the same order, in the right order, if those two aren't swapped at the beginning.
It's solved when the top left corner is 1.
Exactly. It's solved when the top left corner is 1, and then the bottom right corner, there's the space in the bottom right corner, and then the one to the left of the space is d squared minus 1. What? Well, the main function is already calling win on every move. So you don't have to explicitly check if the game has been won because main is already doing that. Main checks every time if the game has been won. You just have to write the actual function won, but you don't have to worry about when to call it because that's already being done. Yeah, the game always starts, well, not necessarily with 15, right? It starts with d squared minus 1 in the top left. What? Yeah, and then it'll go decreasing down to the bottom, except for if it's even, you have to swap the last two.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually look inside the header file, and you'll see that it'll only have the prototype. So it'll just have the type of the function, its name, and what arguments it takes. It won't actually have the function in there, which is similar to when you include libraries. They don't actually have all the code in there. It's the header files of those libraries. So like math.h is the header file for the math library. So it'll have all the functions that are in the math library, all their types and what kinds of arguments they take, but it won't actually have the function written right in there. You have to include it as part of the makefile because the makefile has to know everything that it has to compile with. So it has to know those prototypes in order to be able to compile.
Can we just
include
helpers.h?
Yes, but then if you include helpers.h at the top of helpers.c, you still have to compile helpers.h. You have to compile every part of the code, right? You have to have one, it basically is going to make like one big file that has all the code that you've included, and then it's going to compile that.
On the file of the
yeah. Because you don't have it in in language that the computer can understand. You have it in code that a human can understand. You have it in, I mean, a human can and a machine can, but there's an intermediary step where it has to be compiled into zeros and ones. It's the same thing. Except there's no library for these particular helper functions. So you can't include a library. It's kind of like we've written a library of functions for you. Or you're going to write it, actually. No, helpers is not an established or existing. Oh, that's where the confusion is. Okay. Yeah, no, helpers is what you're writing. You're writing helpers.c. Yeah, it doesn't already exist. Good. Thanks for coming, guys. Good luck.